So thank you. I'd just like to start by thanking you, actually. Thank you so much for inviting me to do this here, go over these teachings of the Lojong teachings, training the mind and body chitta, Arialoka. Just as I was preparing my notes for today's session, I've been transferring them from written notes onto my laptop. It's just like, I just to be able to do that quietly.
Yeah.
I'm just incredibly grateful. I'm getting the opportunity to tune into this material again, and it's really close to my heart, and it's informing. I've been noticing just because I was gearing up to doing this with you, this retreat. It's informing my meditation already in the morning, you know, kind of clarifying things a bit for me. So any time that you invite somebody over to present something, it's a tremendous opportunity for that person, because you deepen your understanding of it. And so I think people might not realize how important it is that you do give me and other people that opportunity to do that. And I hope you all get lots of that kind of opportunity to do that kind of work in the future, because it deepens your practice so much, I find. Anyway, that is just to start us off with. But where we're really, really starting is obviously with 2,500 years ago, when we have the Buddha, a person who is going to become the historical Buddha, is coming into contact with suffering, human suffering, seeing suffering in other people, noticing suffering in himself, and then going on that journey, on that quest to alleviate suffering. So the whole history of Buddhism starts with an altruistic impulse.
Mm-hmm.
It's not coming from the Buddha's wish to only alleviate his own suffering. It is really that desire and heartfelt wish, really strong longing to alleviate everybody's suffering, and that is where Buddhism began, and that is also the heart of the mind training that we'll be doing this week, that altruistic impulse, the exchanging self and other, is at the heart of these teachings. So this exchanging self and other has a wisdom component to it, to see on a really deep level, look into the mind, look into how the nature of mind, like how phenomena start to develop in the mind, and really directly seeing that there is no separation in experience, there is no separation between self and other. So that is that wisdom aspect of the teachings, which you could also say is absolute bodhicitta. We'll go into that tomorrow. And on the other side, you've got the compassion aspect, is that on seeing suffering, whether it's in your own being or in others, that you get that heart impulse. It's a physical thing even. It's sort of feeling in the heart like, I'd like to do something, I'd like to reach out, I'd like to do something to somehow help or be a solution or part of the solution to alleviate that. So you get these two aspects that are, you could say, describing that process of exchanging self and other. I don't know whether that makes sense at this point, but I think it's important to say it right now, because it's at the heart of what we'll be looking into with these teachings. So, as with all of the Buddhist teachings, they're not there to solve what is good, because what is good doesn't need to be repaired, does it? I mean, if something is good, there's no use repairing it. It's okay as it is. So it's all about finding a solution for suffering. And in the tradition, it says that there's three types of suffering. You may have heard of those, or you may not. So there's these three kinds of suffering, and I found a line in one of the, suttas, and it's, there's three forms of stressfulness. I think it's probably a Tanisara translation. He used that word stressfulness for dukkha, or suffering. There is the stressfulness of pain, the stressfulness of fabrication and the stressfulness of change. So we have these three types of suffering that that we are dealing with on a daily basis, I should say, or second by second even, is that you get the pain that comes of just having a human body, having a human mind, you know, the pain of the anyway, you know about pain, don't you? Pain in the body, the pain in the mind, emotion, all of that. So that is one type of suffering. And then there is the suffering that comes from that things are changing, and you're clinging to things as they are, but they're changing, so that causes pain, you know. Things that you were hoping were going to stay along, they're not. That's such is the nature of life. So that also causes pain, so that is a type of pain. And then lastly, you have that pain that comes from the mismatch between how reality unfolds and your hopes and ideas about that, what's actually happening and what you would like to happen. So that is another type of pain. So the solutions for all this suffering stuff, and we're not saying there isn't any there's a lot of good as well, but that is not the problem, if you see. I mean, that's why we're emphasizing the suffering. So all the teachings lead to hopefully some sort of end to that. So that is what the Buddha taught. And in terms of the Lojong, the mind training, we're mainly focusing on that aspect, what is called bodhicitta, the heart longing for freedom. So you've got the bodhi bit, which is the awakening bit, and the citta is heart mind. So it's the heart mind longing to free itself, you could say. So that is a definition of bodhicitta. So we're trying to develop the bodhicitta with these teachings, but it's not different from what you see in the earlier tradition, just the tradition that you find in the Pali Canon, which is about the Brahmaviharas. It's about developing or tuning into these four immeasurable qualities. So it's not different at all in that sense. So bodhicitta is not different from developing these four immeasurable qualities. And also another path that you might be familiar with is the developing of the six perfections. So that is also the six perfections is also a way through, a way into developing bodhicitta. So you find it in the Bodhicharvatara, for instance. You find also all these journeys towards developing these six perfections. So in terms of what it seems that we're doing wrong, as it were, if there is such a thing as wrong, I'm not totally sure of that, is that in the way that we respond to the world, we seem to always want to put our own interest first, and that doesn't provide the right context. That's not going to lead to any kind of salvation or solution in that sense. And we're making mistakes two ways. We're making a mistake to always put our own interest first, and we're also making a mistake to always put our own interest last, somehow, if you see what I mean. So there's always that kind of tension that we're working with. Anyway, we'll go into this a bit more, hopefully, later on. So I was saying this thing about the self-interest, putting the self-interest first, because historically it seems to be the case that this Lojong tradition developed in the 11th century when the Dharma practitioners in Tibet were starting to put their own interest too much at the foreground. So you know how a lot of these, you could say, turnings of the wheel of the Dharma, they're about corrections, aren't they? And so this one, so you could say the Lojong is the kind of turning of the wheel, is a correction to solve that problem of self-importance, people putting their own interest first and using the Dharma to prop up their own personality and So obviously the Dharma, you could use it. You could use it in all kinds of ways, can't you? You know the that metaphor about the snake, probably. So you know that Dharma is like a snake. So if you grab it behind the head, it can't bite you. But if you grab it by the tail, it will. Everything is like that. You know, you can use it well, or you can, you know, abuse it, frankly. So at that point, apparently in Tibet, the 11th century, that was starting to happen in the community, people practicing the Dharma. So this is why these teachings were sought out and were starting to develop. And it, in the 11th century, Tibet, it starts with Atisha. I think some of you may have heard of Atisha. And Atisha hears about this very accomplished teacher and practitioner who lives in Sumatra. And he's called Sarlingpa, and he's also in you could also find his name as Dhammakirti. Dhammakirti is sometimes called Dhammakirti, sometimes he's called Sarlingpa, and he lives in Sumatra. Now, he's, you know, I've just flown from London to Boston, and you know, that's like in 10 hours you door to door, you know, you're on the other side, but it's very different, isn't it, if you live in the mountains in Tibet and you decide to go to a teacher in Sumatra. So it must have taken him months and months and months. I think I have read somewhere it must may have taken him a year to get to this teacher. And it also signifies that in that motivation to start to seek out something that is really, really helpful, teachings that are really helpful. And then he studied with Sarlingpa, Atisha. I really hope I've got this right, but I think I do. And then he goes back to Tibet. And then 50 years later, you have somebody called Chikawa. You probably used to weird Buddhist names by now. So this is a person called Chikawa. And Chikawa is the person who's then he's structuring the mind point teaching, so he's kind of really making it into a system, as it were.
How do you spell?
Chikawa.
Yeah.
Chikawa.
Oh, thank you.
Chikawa. And then we fast forward to the 19th century, and you get a teacher called Zhang Gong Gongtrou. And he's written a book that is used by most of the practitioners of this system as some sort of standard work. I've got a copy of it, which I left in my room, which I'll leave out on the table. You could have a look if you like. And then from there on, there's lots of people practicing it, lots of different traditions. It's been practiced in quite a number of Buddhist traditions, and I think you know there are quite a few of those Buddhist traditions, at least four or five, and then there's all these different branches in it. And then we get to the more present time, and we're here in America, and Jogyam Trungpa is somebody who practices the 7.9 training, and he's founded the Shambhala tradition. I think you've got quite a few organizations here on the side of the East Coast, I think, of people practicing that. And then his main, the people who are most known in the Buddhist world today, who are using the system, are, it's Pema Chodron is actually the main person. So all of her books that you'll be reading, I don't know whether you have or you haven't, but all of her books are informed by this. And a lot of her books actually incorporate parts of this, somehow are motivated by this, contextualized by this system, Lojong, mind training. And then there is another student of his, Judith Leaf. I think she's also somebody who's written quite a few books, articles in Tricycle, giving retreats and that kind of thing. So that is that Chogyam Trungpa side. But then obviously there's other people from other traditions as well. And then somebody who comes to mind from my kind of circle of sphere of influence, as it were, is Lama Tilman, who used to be called Lama Lundrup, and most of you might not know him because he's been working a lot on the more in the UK and Germany and France. So I have been to I'm kind of familiar with his work, and I've been quite inspired by his take on all of this. And then we're in the Triratna context. Obviously, we need to contextualize it in our context. And I have been doing this retreat on this, or two retreats on this, with Sadhanandi. I think some of you might know Sadhanandi. Mm. She's currently the chair of the Adhisthana project in the UK. This is also where Sangraksha is still alive and flourishing. And so she told me a few years ago that when we were starting a retreat on this topic, that Sangharakshita had started a seminar on this when he was living in Birmingham, and they're still doing that actually, that there's a few people coming and they're doing a really intensive Dharma training program for maybe 5 months, 6 months. Mm. They used to have a yearly program, and in that program for I think it was guys participating, mm-hmm. he started doing a seminar on this, and then he was struck by his mm-hmm. insomnia stuff. I think this must have been 2003, so he's kind of not able to finish that, to continue with that. I just wanted to say that very clearly, that there is no seminar by Sangharakshita on this topic. So in that sense, we have quite a lot of order members in Triratna that are practicing Lojong, and I'm just trying to explain how it fits in with what we're doing in Triratna. So people such as Dhammadina, she has delivered, you can listen to them on Free Buddhist Audio, talks on 7-point mind training. This is like 15 years ago or so. Subhuti is doing quite a lot of things with 7-point mind training. He's done some seminars with the college, I believe, and given talks on it. Ratna Dharani, who's my public preceptor, by the way, she's done stuff on 7-point mind training. And then we have some people who practice this on a daily basis in the order as well. The people like Vasantra, you may have heard of him. And then Vijayamala is also practicing this. And they're also connected with this Lama that I just mentioned, Lama Tilman. And then Prakasha, that is a teacher. I know that he's not very well known here, but in the UK, he's been quite influential in terms of doing order retreats, offering order retreats, several a year in the recent past. So yes, I just thought I would say that is how our tradition, as it were, has these Lojong practitioners in it, and those people giving retreats. And that is how this kind of information is disseminated, as it were. It's just through people who are practicing this, the order members, and then either doing a retreat on it or talks on it or that kind of thing. And now I'm coming to what Amalad asked me yesterday. What is your personal connection to Lojo? So I think my first introduction to this topic of 7-point mind training, it was quite peculiar actually, because I kind of seemed to just stumble into it. And I was on a retreat in the teaching team with quite a few others, and I was preparing a talk on compassion for the retreat, and I happened to have in my tent, this is a Buddha food retreat, a magazine. Shambhala Swami it was, mm-hmm. and it had an article in it about 7-point mind training, and there was one big slogan that was, you know, one of the headers for the article was always meditate on what provokes resentment. So always meditate on what provokes resentment. And somehow me preparing my talk and that slogan, it kind of started to spark me off. It really inspired me. And another thing that happened on that retreat was that I had an experience of claustrophobia in my tent one night. I woke up in my tent and it was just, I borrowed my tent of someone. I borrowed my tent. She said, oh, yes, quite a spacious tent, this one. And that she was like one head smaller than I am. So I was actually in this tent. It was really small. And I woke up one night and I was like, yeah, you see, my glasses fell down, just to illustrate the angst that came up. Yeah, completely claustrophobic, I can't describe it, just in that tent, like, I just felt buried in that tent. And it's just quite interesting because claustrophobia, in some sort of way, not to be unkind or anything, it's like if you visualize ego clinging, claustrophobia is like, that's the height of that, it's like, you know, it's just like all this tension is like, something is going to happen to me. So, and I happened to read an article by Pema Chodron on the Tonglen, and she uses claustrophobia as an example of what to work with in the Tonglen practice. So it kind of all came together, and then I also found that 4 out of the 6 team members of that retreat were actually Lojong practitioners. So it just seemed like it just kind of seeped in, and that really sparked me off. And then after that, later in that year, I did a solitary, and I did all of the everything. I did everything I did was on Lojong, and that's in the course of that. I also made all these, I'll show you later. I had just done a course of calligraphy, so I made all these slogans in calligraphy. I did that on my solitary, so I've been using them ever since. And then actually, I just started, I took it as a topic for one of our city retreats and just started sharing my interest with others. And that's how it happened. And since then, yeah, I've been leading a few retreats on it, days on it, all sorts of things. So now I thought I could also put in my disclaimer. Because I think, as with all the Dharma teachings, actually, it's like, it always feels like you're scratching the surface somehow. It's just weird, isn't it? It's just endless. Now, if you go, now I'm getting it, but now it goes on and on and on. You go deeper and deeper and deeper with it. And so in that sense, I do feel I'm scratching the surface, but also I've done quite a lot of reflection on it. But in terms of the disclaimer, in the Tibetan tradition, this material is often taught as a transmission. So you get a group of people together, and you'll be led through all of the slogans, all of the teaching, the background, the preliminaries, the whatever. So it's like a big, big, big thing, and it takes quite a lot of time. We're not the Tibetan tradition, as you may know, we're the Theravada tradition, and we don't do transmissions. We just don't do them, do we? We just don't. So this is not going to be a transmission. Okay? This Lojong that we're doing this week, it's not a transmission. And also because our particular setup for a retreat is that we've got people coming in, and we've got people going, so we wouldn't be able to do it as such either. So, and I have been teaching parts of it as well, just as tools. You could take parts of the points as tools to work with your with spiritual practice. So I would suggest that we take this as an inspiration rather than as a transmission, if you see what I mean. So just see what you pick up out of it and how it could be helpful to you. So that's what I have to say about the history of this system, the Lojong, the mind training. So Lojong just means mind training. It's a translation for mind training, Lojong. And the mind training, this is the 7-point mind training. You could say a lot of the stuff we're doing is mind training anyway, but this is the 7-point mind training. So let me see where I am at. I'll just give you an overview of the mind training. And yes, behind me, I just thought I'd lay it out. These are all the slogans. in the mind training. And the 7 points, as you might have guessed, it's called being called 7-point mind training. And there's 59 slogans. And the 59 slogans are distributed over the 7 points. And so I don't know whether you can see that from that distance. I've got no idea, but we've got point one here, which is just the one slogan. And then there's point two, three, four, five, six, and seven. Six and seven have most of the slogans, and we'll be doing that in one day at the end of the week, because actually they're more of the nature of advice, and they're not the heart of the teachings. So the heart of the teachings, I should say, that's what we'll be doing tomorrow. So that's about bodhicitta. That's the teachings, it's instructions around developing bodhicitta. So that's point two. Point one is training in the preliminaries, which I'll be saying something about after I've gone over the overview. And then in point three, there are instructions on how to incorporate or work with the mind training in all aspects of your life, or particularly, you know, everything that comes up in life can be utilized to practice this mind training with. So that is what point three is about. And point four is about all the effort that we're putting into the Dharma training. There's a description of 5 types of effort that that we're making for Dharma training, and so that is what that point is about. And then we have point five, and point five is about how to evaluate where you're at with your training. So I've been training for 20 years or whatever, or 30 years, how 10 years. How am I doing with it? Am I making progress? And then be really honest with that, like really looking in the mirror and see, okay, I could do a bit more here, and I've done really well here. Yeah, so that's that point. Point six is about the bonds, the samayas, the vows, the promises I'm making in relation to the practice. And then the last point is a bit, it's just all sorts of, it's like a whole bundle, heap of different types of advice. Yeah.
Did you? Okay for questions.
Yeah, sure.
You talked about the fifth one being evaluating.
Yeah.
Are the tools that are taught applicable to other aspects of practice?
Yes.
To determine whether...
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. At least that's certainly how I'm using it, and how I'm going to suggest people using it. Yes. So that is the overview. So I'll just go into the. I think I'll just go into the first point then. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the first point, and I shall later in the week we'll be offering them all to the shrine. So they'll all be on there at the end of the week, but I don't know quite how, but I'm going to put them all on the shrine. So that is the first of the point, which only has one slogan, which is very simple. First, train in the preliminaries. First, train in the preliminaries. That is our first point. But obviously it's not as simple as it sounds, because it's like quite a lot to unpack there, isn't there, for us training the preliminaries. It's actually referring to what you were just asking about. Do the groundwork being all the practices that we're already doing. So that's all the practice that we're already doing. And all the practices that we've learned, that we've been taught. And what I thought we could do that now is, let's just take 5 minutes again to just reflect on the practices that you already learned, that you're already doing, Dharma practice. And then after that 5 minutes, we'll just have a space where we can come up with, like, you know, what kind of practices do we have between us, Dharma practices? Just reflect on the practices that you have already learned. So I thought it would be good to hear a few of the practices that we've learned. Anybody any an offer?
Practices on the mat, so different meditation practices that I've learned.
Okay.
Then it just starts to open up. Mm-hmm. So the precepts.
Yes, precepts, so the ethical precepts.
The three-legged stool, meditation, ethics, and wisdom, the Eightfold Path.
Yes, so the Dharma teachings that we've learned about. Yeah.
You know, after reading Ratnaguna's The Art of Reflection,
yes,
added that.
Absolutely, reflection, very powerful tool.
The study,
yes,
of the Dharma,
yes,
in
the Dharma
its many
study
forms.
Yes.
And for me, one of the most significant practices is spiritual friendship.
Okay.
Yes. Both horizontal and vertical.
Yes, okay.
So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, well, you've got quite a few.
It's enough for about 10 lifetimes.
Well, we've got a few there, yeah. So that's we're doing quite a bit of work there, aren't we?
Yeah.
Any other offerings that we haven't heard about yet?
Yeah, I have a particular focus on learning to be patient.
Yeah.
There are a number of recurring circumstances where I feel particularly impatient.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, trying to remember to
yeah,
that I don't need to be impatient about it.
Yeah.
Just that there it is, you know.
Yeah.
It's working, and and because it's, I have occasions during every day to feel impatience. It's really in the forefront of my practice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you could say that. You could say it's one of the perfections, isn't it, Shanti? So it's you could see it as that is an ethical practice as well, isn't it? In that sense, it's like not speaking out of that and knowing that if you continue with that, it's not going to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
So that's great. Any other offerings for the big pot?
Faith and devotion.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. So we have faith and devotion. And the tools, what's the tools that you use?
Oh gosh.
Ah,
so many. But learning about the forms that enlightenment takes, you know, learning about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, chanting. Puja, going for refuge and prostration practice, sadhana practice, mandala offering practice, those are the main ones.
Yeah.
Name a few.
Yeah.
Bowing practice.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, raising the hands, just doing the mudra.
Yeah.
And the inner attitude of it's hard to put a word on it, but surrendering in some way.
Yeah.
Or the inner attitude of surrendering or offering of oneself.
Yeah.
In sense of self.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just
huge.
Thank you. To be honest, I think we've had most of them. We've heard most of them. Is there any more to add to the? I mean, because we were not talking about only, you know, the very specific practices, but you know, we've got ethical practice, we've got devotional practice, we've got our meditation practice. Anything that we haven't mentioned?
I guess stupa practice falls into what you were talking about, right?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's primarily devotional practice.
Yeah. Okay. But I'm kind of thinking we've had all the categories now. Am I right?
Well, the only one I was thinking of that might not have been directly covered is working with mental states.
Yeah. Yeah.
So bringing awareness to our the nature and quality of our experience at each moment, and observing which mental states tend to get us into trouble and which can have beneficial
outcomes. So attending with mindfulness to to mental states. Okay, I think I'm happy with all of that. I mean, it's quite a lot, and it's quite encouraging, isn't it, to know that we have all these tools and we're actually utilizing them. We're actually practicing quite a lot, I would say. So with all of us here. So in terms of train in the preliminaries, that sort of practices, you just I don't think that's gonna stop. If you see what I mean, I think there is sometimes a tendency for people who want to just go to the highest teachings, like in one big jump, and kind of forgetting about all the work that needs to be done beforehand. I've learned, and I'm sure people might agree, that spiritual life practice isn't like that. Change happens, but it's very, very slow. Change in ourselves, it's very, very slow. And you know, we're doing it, but it's slow. And it's not like we can stop doing it. And then sort of when we get to a certain point, because all of us need to keep practicing those basic practices. Like, I don't think there is a point where you could stop practicing mindfulness of body, if you see what I mean. Hello. If you think you're too advanced for that, maybe think again. I don't know. Actually, you could say that body practices, we didn't really mention that specifically, but that they're also quite important, aren't they? So train in the preliminaries, so do the groundwork, so all the practices you're doing, connecting to those positive qualities wherever you find them. If devotion practice really helps to draw those out for you, that is really something that is incredibly important in the work, having that aspiration, that positive connection, that there is something that to be developed that's bigger than where you're at right now. So some sort of exemplification to have that. And to also have the support in terms of a faith, feeling like there is the support of that type of influence, as it were, the support of... Well, you could say, if it works for you, the support of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas is always there, isn't it? And I know it doesn't work for everyone. That's why I'm careful how I phrase it. Okay, so that's the preliminaries. And then, so do the groundwork. Do the groundwork. And then the next that the text goes into, in terms of the 7-point mind training, is it goes into the four reminders. So the four reminders are part of this point. And all of this, I think, is all about motivating yourself to do the practice. I feel us cataloguing the practices that we're doing is quite motivating. And so we're motivating ourselves for any kind of mind training practice by reflecting on the four reminders. So the four reminders are, I'm sure most of you have heard of them, but the first one is the preciousness of the human body. And that might sound quite self-evident, but I know there's many occasions where I'm not aware of the preciousness of the human body, neither my own or other people's. So it's a good thing to reflect on. And I've got a quote here, which I quite like. Used well, this body is a ship to liberation. Otherwise, it's an anchor in samsara. Used well, this body is a ship to liberation. Otherwise, it's an anchor in samsara. So the body is the agent of everything that's skillful and also everything that's unskillful. But most of the time, when this reminder is coming up, when you hear about this, you hear the story about the turtle and the ocean and the what is the thing called, that the
what's the preserver,
that thing, that device that helps you, saves you. if you happen to be swimming in the ocean. So this blind turtle in the depths, coming up in this big ocean, and then coming up right, sticking his head right through that life device, whatever you call it. That is the, they say, that is the chances that you have a human body, and actually also using it to practice the Dharma. It's minute. Another way into it, if you're more so inclined, is statistical. I've once given a talk about insects and Dharma, believe it or not. And in my reading, and I think I might misremember this, but it might be that for every human being, there might be about 16 billion insects mm-hmm. on this earth. So you can say, oh yeah, well I've got a human body, I'm not insects. This is true. But just think about the statistical likelihood that you are a life form born on planet Earth and you're taking the form of a human body. That, yeah. It puts it into some sort of perspective, doesn't it? How rare an opportunity it is to have a human body at your disposal, as it were, and how incredibly lucky we are if all the faculties are intact. I mean, there's such a lot, as we know, that can go wrong, so have all our faculties intact. So the preciousness of the human body and use it well. Let's use it well. Let's use it while we're having it. And let's be honest about the truth that most of the time we're probably not aware how precious an opportunity is. I mean, I'm not the only one who falls asleep and is not awake in terms of, yeah. Being present. Yeah, so that's the preciousness of the human body. And then as a joined up with that, this pair really, is the reminder about the impermanence, the truth of impermanence and death. That is the second reminder, the truth of impermanence and death. And that's the fragility, the fragility of this life, the fragility of this body. And, well, Dhammasuri isn't here today, well, partially because she needs to go to a funeral. And the funeral is somebody who had an accident. Uh-huh. And somebody she knows quite well. And, yep, so one day to another, same age, that is the end of that life. And I've been thinking, we're getting a lot of these reminders, aren't we, these days? There's mm-hmm. lots of disasters, terrorist attacks, whether domestic or not domestic. There's all sorts of reminders at the moment. The hurricanes, yeah. Mm-hmm. All sorts. Now in London, we've got our terrorist attacks quite frequently these days. So the preciousness of human life, and I am often reminded actually of an order member called Manjushvara, because he was a poet. He used to be one of the people leading the Wolf at the Door events. So he was, I often remember this when I'm on retreat, especially if I'm in a team, because he was just sitting together with a bunch of people in a team meeting when he had some sort of stroke, and that was the end of him, mm-hmm. that in terms of his life. Mm-hmm. So, and a thing that really struck me so much when I heard about it, when they went to his room, there was a list of people who needed to be contacted in case of the eventuality of him dying on that retreat, which is amazing. I've always found that amazing, that detail, that he actually had thought about the possibility of that happening. And
had, he had a condition, so he knew it could be something
Yeah. Well, that's... But again, I still find it amazing to have that ready.
Yeah.
And the Tibetans, not all of them, but some of them have this practice that when they're taking their shoes off before they go to bed, they kind of tell themselves, like, okay, I don't know whether I'm going to put these shoes back on again in the morning. And it is like that, isn't it? It is just like that. And we've got this idea that we are going to live at a particular time, or we're going to have a particular average lifetime, or we've got this right to live at a particular length of time. But obviously, such is not the nature of reality. The nature of reality is that life is very fragile, and And sometimes we get these reminders, don't we? I mean, you call them reminders. They're not reminders for nothing. You often see people coming to Buddhist centers, for instance, because they've had a loss of some kind. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they're coping with grief. Or there's often this grief about their own body as well, because that's the truth of impermanence is also applying to your own body. I was speaking to my mother over the phone the other day, and she's getting macular degeneration. So, and she's got this cataract in the other eye. So, like, in one moment to another, all of a sudden, with one eye, the only thing she's seeing is like a black spot, and she sees some stuff around it. But that is not a journey that you could go back on. If you see, I mean, that is what is happening. She's very good with it, by the way. And anyway, it's starting to sound a bit depressing here, doesn't it? But the point of it all is that combined with the preciousness of human life and the very fragile nature of it, let's practice while we can. That's the idea. Let's do something.
No time to lose.
No time to lose, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. So that is the message here of some of these reminders. And as with these people who come to the center because they've had a loss or something, stopped working or whatever, it puts things that are important into stark perspective. Mm-hmm. If something like that happens, it really shows you what is most important in your life. So I just thought we'll just do a few minutes of sitting with this. And then I'll do the last two reminders, and then we'll have a slightly longer break, okay? I hope that you can bear with me. Yeah. So I just do a few minutes to reflect on this, or just to be with these two reminders. The preciousness of the human body and the truth of impermanence and death. So the third reminder. is about karma and rebirth. And basically, it points to the same thing, you know, actions have consequences. And I know the word rebirth often, well, people have got particular ideas about it, but might not believe in it, or doesn't really matter that much in terms of this reminder is about actions have consequences. It does obviously matter quite a lot, but let's not go into it right now. This is such a big topic. So actions have consequences. What I do has consequences. Mm-hmm. What we're doing, how we're acting in the world, have consequences. And I started to see it a bit in terms of rebirth as recycling. You could even see it as compost, the compost of the mind matter, as it were. And the whole point is to leave it in the best state possible. And I don't know whether you're going to leave it or take it with you, if you see what I mean, but it doesn't really matter that much, because the idea is that it really matters what you're doing. So the state, working with your mental states, is incredibly important, and it does have an effect. So however it works, the idea is that the mind stream, however it's left when the body dies, has some sort of effect, somehow, however, in whatever way, some sort of continuum, some sort of continuation. And I don't know whether we need any more convincing, really, of that our actions have consequences. I think you can see it every day. You can see it with everything you're doing. That's the whole principle of ethics. If you didn't believe that actions have consequences, then what's the point of being Buddhist? It's at the heart of being a Buddhist. Because if you don't believe that you can change, or that you can make a change, I mean, what's the whole point? What's the point of even making a start with it? So you could just leave it at that. I'm kind of planted this big sort of elephant in the room, which is rebirth. But you can make of it what you like. Just bear in mind, actions do have consequences. It really is true. That's at the heart of this reminder.
Can I offer something?
Yes.
I like the compost image.
Yeah.
And here, we compost all the time, but we don't put commercially raised flowers in our compost because they have pesticides.
Yeah.
So this is a simple example that helps me remember. I don't want to have poisons in the compost of my mind.
No, exactly.
Because that will affect the next growing season, whatever, if that's tomorrow or the next life.
Yes, well, that is what I was hinting at. So, because often at this stage, the literal mind takes over and we started to think about the mechanics of this whole business, like how is that going to happen, the rebirth, and how is all the particles, whatever, how is that going to work? But it's a principle, isn't it? In that sense, you don't want that poison to be left in the compost.
Yeah.
Whatever it's going to be affecting, however it's going to affect the future, as it were, future actions, future shape of life in some form. Okay, so that's our third reminder. And the fourth reminder is about the unsatisfactoriness of samsaric existence. The unsatisfactoriness of samsaric existence. And I talked a bit about this already when I talked about these three types of dukkha. It's particularly referring to the type of dukkha about getting what you don't want and not getting what you want. That is what is hinted at here, the unsatisfactoriness of samsaric existence. And yes, you could also say, yes, it's the mismatch again between reality and your thoughts and hopes and expectations about what's going to happen next. or any kind of fantasy, any kind of speculation versus how things are really unfolding. It's just like a huge source of dukkha, isn't it? And it's I was actually in meditation this morning, just noticing just the tension in my, wherever it is, the mind-body construct of just not wanting my experience. It's such a source of tension in our being, that kind of, I don't want this, no. Yeah. And yes, you could say it's fabrication versus reality. And in the Buddhist project, it would be to wake up to reality and to not dwell in fabrication.
Mm.
And that's our project. Wake up from our fabrication and be with reality. So it is really so deeply ingrained in everything, like we've got this right to occupy a particular space or live a particular length of time. And then it's such a surprise, isn't it, when it doesn't happen that way. So life does have other plans, usually. And the thing about this is everybody has this. Everybody is suffering from this principle. And we're all in the same boat in that sense. So this is the human condition. So in that sense, that being the human condition that we all share is a whole basis for compassion.
Mm.
That we are suffering from our own fabrication. We're suffering from everything we're constructing in the mind. That is that mismatch between mind-made and actual reality. So, that is the first train in the preliminaries. That's it. Only that. I'm doing a whole retreat on this, the four reminders, at the end of the year. Because, you could just take it as, you could practice forever with them, can't you? But mainly this point is mainly about motivating us for the practice of any kind of mind training. So it doesn't mean particularly Lojong, the system that we're doing this week, this weekend, but any kind of Dharma practice, these reminders are to motivate us for that. So I think that's all I've got to say for this morning.
Mm.